Okay, well, I think maybe we can get started then. Today I have truly the great pleasure of introducing Professor Katja Scheinberg from Lehigh University. She's at the Department of Industrial Engineering and Operations Research. Katja is actually originally from Moscow, where she obtained a master's degree in OR from the Lomonosov Moscow State University. She then came here to the U.S. and did a PhD at Columbia with Don Goldfarb and finished in 97, and then joined the IBM Watson Research Center. After that, she had sort of a short stay at Columbia visiting professor, and then after that joined Lehigh. Katja has sort of very broad interest in the sense of doing both, if you wish, practice and theory of algorithms. She's especially interested in convex optimization, derivative-free optimization, machine learning, quadratic programming. And, for instance, in 2008, she produced a book on derivative-free optimization with Andy Kahn and Luis Vicente. And today what she's going to do is to give us sort of an overview and tutorial, if you wish, on both models and algorithms for the optimization for machine learning. Okay, so Katja, welcome and thank you for joining us. Katja?
Okay, thank you. Thank you for the introduction and thank you for inviting me to speak. So yeah, indeed, I will talk about one of my interests that's been, you know, part of my research for a decade by now, but I will not get to talk so much about the actual algorithms that I'm working on because that's fairly technical and we can certainly talk about it offline with anybody who is interested. I will raise I will talk about the models because they're interesting in their own right, and hopefully I will show how these models are similar in certain ways but have, you know, their own special structures, and then explain why these structures are challenging for optimization algorithms. And then in the end, I will talk about lately my interest specifically which algorithms I'm working on and what are their special features and why are they suitable for these problems. Okay? So I have quite a few pictures here, so this is hopefully will make you know, the presentation over the phone easier to digest. So we start with a very simple binary classification problem, so we'll kind of warm up with just some ideas. So, you know, if you have two sets of points, and many of you might have seen it before, but it's you know, we'll kind of see where it's leading us. So we have two sets of points in n-dimensional space, and let's say we know that some of these points belong to a green set and some of these points belong to a blue set. So we're in slide two now. We're going to go to slide three, and not sure why I'm not moving. Okay, next one. Yes, slide three is basically... let's say we're given a gray point. So you see the gray point on the slide, and somebody is asking us what color this should be. Should it be green or should it be blue? And, you know, just looking simply at this picture, it's fairly clear that this should be a green point, right? But on the other hand, if we now go to slide 5 and somebody gives us a gray point right there, then it's much less clear, like this point or maybe this point is even worse, right? So this point, one might say, oh, okay, well, it's kind of closer to the blue set, but this point is really not clear what it should be. So we need some kind of a good rule, which is robust and, you know, hopefully well-justified to what we're seeking is predicting the color or which set the point belongs to when the points that are unlabeled come along. So unlabeled means we don't know which set they come, and we're looking at the situation when we have some labeled sets, that is, that we have some points for which we know what color they are. By the way, I cannot obviously see you, so if there are some questions, you know, feel free to interrupt me. I speak quite fast, but you know, I'm willing to stop at any point.
Yeah, Katja, just a second, because I think some people in the audience are saying, remember, if you look at the email, just call in through the number. So we're not broadcasting the voice through WebEx, okay? So you have to dial in with the telephone number that we gave to us, okay? Thank you. Sorry, Katja, if you want to continue.
Yes, sure, sure. Okay. So we're now on slide 7, and here we'll have a few examples of basically applications of such binary or more generally just classification. So the first one, a very classical example, is optical character recognition. So you have some handwritten digits. It's very widely used right now in recognition of zip codes, automatic reading of zip codes. So you have handwritten digits. Every digit can be represented by a little square of 16 by 16, basically, rows and columns, so 256 pixels. They have possibly gray, white, and black, you know, level of image. Each picture represents a digit. It may be 0 or 2 or 5 or whatever. So there are 10 classes that we want to classify, and the algorithm that learns to recognize these handwritten digits will first get a bunch of examples of each of the digits, learn from that, and then later on when the new digit comes along, we'll be able to automatically recognize which digit it is. Okay, so you have basically your data is in 256 dimensions, and the amount of data can be whatever it is that you give, as many digits as you want to give your algorithm to learn. Face recognition is a much more sophisticated application of the same thing. You either recognize a face specifically from pictures, or there is an issue of face detection, just detecting whether in a video there is a face or not present. That's a much more sophisticated representation. You don't represent it in a simple way as with digits. It's some kind of a non-Euclidean measure and more non-linear representation in a high-dimensional space. So it's a fairly high-dimensional representation, and then again, you might have a lot of faces to recognize from, or you might not. Next one is applications from text and internet. So spam filtering is a very classical example of a classification problem. You know, you learn, the spam filter learns on examples of your emails that you may label as spam and not spam yourself. And clearly it does it by all sorts of, it might be taking just the words as features or word combinations or such things. Your feature space might be the entire English dictionary, and actually more than that. And the classes are whether you basically have a spam or not. There's also text categorization in general. You are searching articles on certain subjects, so you might have articles on a subject of finance, for example, and other articles that you want to classify. Again, the features here would be, so the dimension of the space would be the words in English dictionary or something like that. Ranking of web pages is actually also can be cast as classification problem. It's not maybe so obvious, but when you are putting a query into a web search, the classification there would be to basically predict what page that comes up should be ranked higher. And so basically, how should the pages be ranked, right? If, between two pages, which one should be ranked higher? So that's kind of the classification part of it. Okay, so the applications are, I mean, there's way more than this. This is just gives an example of different sizes of problems that come up. Here's another example from, two examples from medicine. One is in functional magnetic resonance imaging. So it's basically trying to predict functions of the brain. I think one of the studies actually comes from CMU. The people I worked with at IBM, you know, are still actively working in that area, I think, trying to use learning algorithms for improving, certain aspects of neuroscience. So there you collect the information about the oxygenation of the brain during certain activities by looking at the pieces, little tiny, you know, pieces of the brain, which is called, you know, voxels, basically three-dimensional pixels. So you might have about 30,000 of those, and they're all active at different times. And so it's a fairly high-dimensional problem, and then you basically using the activity in the brain, you're trying to predict what the person is experiencing at this point, what kind of emotion or what they're doing and this kind of thing. Breast cancer is a very classical example of classification where you're basically collecting some standard medical test measurements of a patient and then trying to predict the risk level of that patient in terms of breast cancer. So, again, you have some measurements here. The number of measurements is the original feature space is not actually that high. It's just, you know, whatever measurements you'll take of a patient coming into the hospital. But the number of subjects might be very large. It's basically anybody who's been scanned at all for the, you know, relevant features. So it can be a million patients. Okay, so now we're going to slide 10. This is just a very basic high-level mathematical definition of a classification problem. So somebody gives you the labels for certain sets of points. So you have, in general, you have this universe of data label pairs. So you have some kind of data out there for every patient or for every text. There is potentially data you might not know. You might not observe all the data, but it's there. And every data should have a label. You observe a subset of these data, and for that subset, you think you know, well, you, at least you're given the labels. Then given that data that is labeled, you're trying to find a reasonable approximation of a function, which generally will map the data into the label. So whenever the data comes later, you should be able to predict its label with reasonably high accuracy. Okay. So let's go back to our linear classification, and this is the first example of an optimization problem that we'll build up, and that's called the support vector machine. It's so popular that I'm fairly sure that many people had seen it before, but we'll still go over it reasonably quickly. So, again, we're trying to separate, this is slide 12, we're trying to separate two sets of points, the blue and the green, into basically, and the way we will kind of naturally separate them looking at this picture is by drawing a line between the two sets of points, because that seems to be the most natural thing to do, and then which side of the line the next point will fall will tell us basically where, what classification of that point should be. So here is a line, and the line is determined by the vector W here, and which is basically, as we'll see in the next slide, would be, you know, basically the orthogonal vector to this line, and the offset beta, the intercept, right? So we're looking for the W, which is basically a vector in the M-dimensional space, and M is the dimension of our space here. In this case, it's 2. And beta is just a constant. And what we want is basically that all the green points lie on the one side of the hyperplane of this line, in this case, and all the blue points lie on the other side. So here is an example of the line, basically, which is determined by a linear equation saying x1 plus x2 minus 1 equals 0. W in that case is 1, 1. Beta is minus 1. And if we look at all the, basically next line 15, if we look at all the blue points, their values for x1 plus x2 minus 1 will be greater than 0. And the value for the green points would be less than 0. So what we want is basically, it's a very simple linear system of inequalities where we're looking for W and beta so that for all the blue points, the inequalities hold with a positive sign and for all the green points with a negative sign. Now, if the label of the green points is negative 1, so yi for each point here is negative 1 and for this is positive 1, then if we go back to slide 13, we get a general linear expression that we want to hold for all the points, that the label times this linear function for a given point has to be positive. So it's this part inside the parentheses should be negative for the negative class and positive for the positive class. Okay, so that's all very good, but clearly in this case, when we're looking at the situation, we have many possible solutions, right? So we have all of these solutions that I drew here on line on slide 16 have the property that that we desire. So this all these properties would hold. And now the question is, so which one should we choose? Should we choose any one at random? Should we choose one particular one? And, you know, this is very, very obvious that the one we should choose should be somehow basically lie as much in the middle as possible between the two sets. And there is indeed a mathematical justification for that. We can, there are many actually mathematical justifications. Some come from statistics. Here is one which is kind of appeals to me because it's from optimization point of view, and this is robust optimization kind of setting where we say, well, you know, let's pretend that we don't know the points exactly, so we're given these blue points and green points, but actually they are nothing but just some kind of a perturbation of where the points, the true points might be, because all the measurements are taken slightly inexactly. So if we not allow the points to be perturbed, we still want this property to hold that we're separating the points by the hyperplane. So here on slide 17, I basically draw some circles around the points where the true data might lie, and we still want the separation of the actual circles now rather than these little points. So now we're looking, and I'm not going to go through the details of the formulas, but basically what they are here for is to say that, well, we are trying to make sure that separation actually happens while allowing these circles to be as large as possible. So basically allowing for as much perturbation as possible and still separating the two sets. And that leads through, you know, some derivations that we kind of present here, on slide 18, that leads to the following formulation. And it's not a very obvious thing why, but it's actually fairly easy to derive, that we're trying to separate, so we have the same separation conditions that we had before, so we have these inequalities. But now we're looking not just for any W and beta that satisfy this, but we were looking among all such Ws, we're trying to find the W with the smallest norm. So it's some kind of regularization, if you will. So we're trying to find the W of the smallest norm that the condition still holds. And it indeed will be the same as separating with the largest possible margin. As you can see here, we're looking for the line which has basically the largest margin. And that's what support vector machines are. They're large margin classifiers, okay? So now we have an optimization problem. We're minimizing W transpose W, which is the same as minimizing the norm of W, subject to some constraints. So just let's take a moment for a second to think of dimensionality of this problem. So the dimensionality of this problem is the following. The dimension of W, that's the number of variables right now, right? W are variables. Beta is another variable, but that's just one, single element. So the dimensionality of W is dimensionality of your feature space. So in case of, for example, functional MRI, that would be 30,000 voxels. And in case of character recognition, if you're applying just kind of simple linear feature space, it would be 256. And in case of breast cancer, it might be just the number of measurements of a patient, which might be 30 or 50. So it might be small and it might be very large. It depends. And we'll see a little bit later how it can grow. The number of data points is the number of inequalities. So N is the number of data points that are given to us, and that's the number of inequalities. So in terms of, in the case of, say, breast cancer patients, it's the number of patients you've measured, which I said might be a million. In terms of text categorization, it can be the number of articles on the web that you're interested in, which may be very large or may not be so large. It depends what you basically give and classify. This is number of data points that are labeled. So it's not just any number of, in this particular case, it's not just any number of articles out there. It's the one for which you have the subject classification or spam or non-spam for emails and such. So this can be, again, this can be a very large number depending on the situation. So it might also classify, it might be the number of ads on the web that have been clicked by a person looking at a certain query. So this can be also very, very large, but also can be reasonably small, such as the number of subjects in the fMRI test data. That would typically be not a very large number because it's the number of people who actually set an fMRI machine, so that would not usually be so large. Okay, so this is the number of constraints and variables in this problem. So depending on the situation, this may be, as we'll discuss later, is a more challenging or less challenging optimization problem. But this is not the end of the story yet because really, okay, this is all very nice, this optimization problem, but if we go to slide 20, we have a situation where clearly we cannot solve the problem that we just described on the previous slide simply because we have a situation where we have some outliers. So we've either mislabeled some data accidentally or just basically outliers for our experiments, and we have a blue point mixed in with the green and the green mixed in with the blue. So there is no line that can provide this separation. And this is the typical situation, and nobody really wants to separate perfectly. Some error is usually allowed. So if you go to slide 21, this is the true formulation that is usually being used for support vector machines. You allow, so in red, it's basically we represent some kind of error that we allow in our separation, and it is not really, so this variable size are now allowed to be positive, and if they are positive, that means that there is some kind of an error in the separation. We're not separating perfectly, or at least we're not having this perfect kind of margin. I didn't really get into details of that, but instead of a zero, now we have a one, which kind of makes us separate with a large margin, but then we allow ourselves not to be separating with this margin. After all, for certain cases, for some of this data, this is basically going to be the optimization problem that everybody tries to solve. In this case now, the number of variables, so the number of constraints is pretty much the same, except for now we've had these non-negativity constraints, but we've increased the number of variables. So we introduced a variable for every constraint now. So the number of variables is now N plus M, so the number of W's and the number of number of constraints, number of original points, data points. So pretty much whatever is large in our case, be it the dimension of the space or the number of data points, we end up with a fairly large dimensional optimization problem that we need to solve. And as we will possibly discuss a bit later, well, I mean, we can even see it here. So what happens in large-scale optimization fairly often is that it's not a problem because the setting of optimization problem is such that the data matrices that are involved are very sparse. So yes, you have many, many constraints, but each constraint involves only a few variables, let's say. But if we now look at the high-dimensional problems, we would have actually... So if the dimension of W is large, like let's say it's all the words in English alphabet. Well, actually, this is a bad example because that might be sparse. But it's we'll see some examples in a minute. But if let's say W is a really large dimensional, let's say voxels in your brain, that basically the data points represent oxygenation of the brain in every voxel, and it's, you know, this is not usually not zero. It's actually some number that one can collect. And so these basically these inequalities, there's a lot of them, and each of them involve pretty much every variable. So you get very dense data, not every time, but quite often. So you have very large, very high dimensional, and completely dense data in these problems. And that basically prevents us from using off-the-shelf methods, because basically, especially second-order methods, which require building matrices and inverting them and factorizing them, and it becomes really, really impossible. I mean, the some of the problems that are being solved today are of the order of billion data points, and that is really something that is prohibitively expensive with the standard optimization methods. Okay, so this is this was slide 21. Now, slide 22 represents the same problem that is often being addressed, and this is the way I would be looking at the problems later on the, in this particular one as well. So instead of having inequalities, we can rewrite this problem in the following form. And, you know, you can look at it a little bit longer at the previous slide and see why the problem on slide 21 is actually equivalent to the problem on slide 20. But the problem on slide 22. The problem on slide 22 is unconstrained problem, but it now involves this complicated function, which is the sum of the max between 0 and this value that is evaluated for every data point. So it's a sum over all the data points of these little functions, basically. So each term depends on one data point, and then you sum over all data points. And each term is basically a non-smooth function. So you end up with a non-smooth function here, which is the sum of many, many, many terms, okay? So, for example, evaluating the subgradient of such a... So this is a... this function is a sum of two terms. One is a very nice smooth term, possibly high dimensional, but, you know, very particular. So it's W, basically, transpose W. And then the sum of many, many non-smooth terms, all depending on also W. And evaluating the subgradient of such function will involve basically evaluating this term for every data point. So just evaluating a subgradient can take a long time in certain cases. And clearly building second-order information for this function is quite can be prohibitive. All right, so far so good. This is, okay, what I'm going to do now is basically justify why, if we go back to slide 22, why W might be large. It's not only because... And dimension of W and X might be large and dense. It's not only because the original data might lie in a high-dimensional space, but it's actually because we're trying to solve this problem in a more complex situation than we've just described. So if you go to slide 23, it's a very simple example of when linear separation clearly does not work. So in any case, even if we allow for error, there are no outliers here. It's just that drawing a line is not what we should be doing. They're clearly two separate sets. They're very distinct. They can be very nicely separated from each other, just not by drawing a line. So what we do in that case, if we go to slide 23, is we see that a natural thing here would be to draw some kind of an ellipsoid. You know, then the separation would be very nice and very clean. And how we represent an ellipsoid, well, you know, we can represent an ellipsoid as a nonlinear function, but that gets really complicated. It's much easier to represent it as a linear function, but in a different space. So this is what is typically being done. Again, there's a lot of math and details behind it, and I'm not going to go into this, but what is basically, this just gives you a flavor how the function feature space can grow. So a quadratic curve, such as this, you know, dotted line, can be described in two-dimensional space in the following way, right? So the W's are the unknowns that are coefficients of the quadratic curve, and X1, X2, X1 squared, and so on, are the basically the elements that you're combining to get the quadratic curve. Now, instead of looking at a two-dimensional space, you can pretend that you're actually in a five-dimensional space where your features are x1, x2, x1 squared, x1 times x2, x2 squared, and, you know, like that. So in the five-dimensional space, this function that you're writing down here, this quadratic curve is actually represented as a linear function in that five-dimensional space. So now you're doing the same things, but you're working in a five-dimensional space, and you can apply all the same support vector machine technology and all the same things, but you're just, your space has grown. And your space can grow to be something very large, and actually it can be infinite. And there is a technique in support vector machine that can cast this problem in a different way, using kind of some dual representation where you get rid of dimensionality dependence altogether, so you do not anymore depend on dimensionality of the space, but then you heavily depend on the number of data points. And that will be a different representation of the same problem, but again, the optimization problem will depend, the size will heavily depend on the number of data points, and then you'll have very large data that is even sometimes impossible to store on one computer the way it is. So it's it just basically gets very large scale. Okay. So that's basically my pitch for support vector machines. Now I'm going to move to a few more examples on which I'll spend a bit less time. But just to expand basically the machine learning problems, and then we'll see how all these problems are in a way similar. So this is another very nice, very large example, but kind of very neat one. And it's called collaborative filtering in optimization. It's actually called matrix completion. And it became fairly known via this Netflix challenge, which I'll just describe in a minute. It's just a popular example, but the applications are, again, much wider than this particular one. So the Netflix challenge has been out there for a few years. Again, I think there is a team from Carnegie Mellon machine learning group that's been contributing there as well. So I assume most people in the United States know what Netflix is. Those outside might not know, but this is basically a rental company for DVDs, for movies. And one of their advantages is that they, based on your prior rentals and your prior ranking of the movies, they recommend what you would like and what you would not like to see. So they're trying to be personal about explaining what, predicting what a certain customer would like. They had a recommendation system and they wanted to improve it, so they issued a challenge to improve their system by, say, 10% accuracy. So what you need to do is to predict basically ranking of movies for every given user. So what you have mathematically is a big matrix of users and movies. So they have about 17,000 movies in that data set and I think about 500,000 users. So this matrix is partially filled. Some users have filled their rankings for some of the movies. And what you're trying to do is find the rankings of all the users for all the movies, potentially, so that you would recommend them the movies that people would like. I mean, it's not exactly a classification problem, but for every user, in a way, it's a sort of a classification problem. You're trying to decide whether the movie would be ranked 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, for example. But the approach mathematically is slightly different. So you have this partially filled data, and you have, of course, much less data than the missing entries. So it is generally not clear how to fill in such a matrix unless you make certain assumptions. And the assumptions are that all the users basically base their decisions or ranking of the movies on the same set of features. Okay, so you have certain features to movies, be it whether they are, you know, costume, dramas, or comedy, or action, or whether they have certain actors in there, whether they received Oscars, whatever it is. There is a certain not very large set of features that every movie has, and each user values these features differently, but they all look at the same set of features. Now, the really cool thing about this particular setting is that as a people designing machine learning algorithm, we do not need to know what are these features. So this is the kind of the different setting in machine learning versus, say, expert prediction setting. The expert would go and decide what the features are and then try to figure out how each user weighs these features. In this particular setting, all we need to assume is that there's just few features, but we don't know what they are. So there are a few features. Each user weighs them differently, so they have their own function. And if you write down this mathematically, what this would mean, and this matrix that we're seeking, so we're seeking the whole matrix. We know some numbers in that matrix, but we don't know most of them. We're looking for this matrix Y, and now I'm on slide 29. So we're looking for this matrix Y, and this matrix is low rank. So it has to have a low rank because basically every, so it can be represented as a product of two matrices, and U and V, and U is basically for every row of U is the weight for every given user of how they value different features, and every row of V, that is column of V transpose, is the to which extent every movie has those features. And basically, the product of these two matrices should give us the matrix of law rank, okay? That is the ranking. So what we're trying to find is we're trying to find the matrix. Now I'm on slide 30, trying to find the matrix of law rank that has given values. So we have, as we're trying to find the matrix of rank as low as possible, which satisfies the following conditions: that given entries, for given set of entries, the values are fixed. Okay? So this problem itself is actually NP-hard, and nobody solves it that way. But it has a convex relaxation, and instead of minimizing the rank of the matrix, we actually minimize the sum of singular values. And there are good reasons why this is a good relaxation, but basically the sum of singular values of the matrix kind of stand as a nice tightest convex relaxation of the number of non-zero, non-singular values, and that's what a rank actually is. And so then we end up on slide 31 with a problem like this, which is a convex optimization problem, very nice one, can be solved in theory in polynomial time. So you're trying to minimize the nuclear norm of this matrix, which is nuclear norm is the sum of the singular values, with some of the matrix values being fixed. And now, of course, presumably we have a noisy setting, so some of the rankings might not be exactly as we assume they should be. So typically what you do is you relax the condition that the values, so now in slide 32, we look at the still convex relaxations of this problem. And there are two forms, and I'm particularly interested in the second form, but both forms are valid. So in one case, we just relax the condition, and in the other case, kind of like in the support vector machine, we add with a penalty the error between the entries that we should be predicting should be satisfying correctly. So the given values should be observed in the matrix that we're seeking, but we're allowing for some error and we're adding it to the penalty. So this is an objective function that basically we're trying to optimize here. In this case, we have a non-smooth term, which is this one, the nuclear norm, and the smooth term is this loss function. But again, we have a sum of two functions, and the dimensionality is pretty large. So think about the number of variables. The number of variables is the number of entries in this matrix, X. And that is basically, in the case of Neslik's problem, it's 500,000 times 17,000. So that's pretty much, a very, very large matrix. And in many other applications, this is the case. You get very, very large matrices. So the standard, this problem, for example, in theory can be efficiently solved by applying interior point methods to semi-definite programming semi-definite programming reformulation of this problem, for those who know what this is. And so in theory, it's very nice and efficient, but a semi-definite programming problem cannot possibly even begin to handle, interior point methods cannot possibly begin to handle problems of this size at this point. So again, the off-the-shelf methods do not work here. Now, another very large class of problems basically is sparse regression. These are very easy to describe, basically. So what you're trying to do is you're trying to basically solve a linear regression problem. So you have some kind of data. You're trying to fit a linear regression into them. Now, I've changed my notation slightly from support vector machines. X is now my variables. In support vector machines, X was data. And A is my data, just because, somehow I got used to that. Then basically I have, so this is slide 32, I'm sorry, and this is the linear regression in general. I have the solution here for linear regression as it is, which is basically, just pseudo-inverse of, this matrix A. Okay, but in many cases, the regression we're trying to build is based on the data. So the linear regression in a classical sense, again, back to slide 35, is used when you have a lot of data, so the amount of data is much larger than the dimension, okay? And here's an example where we have a lot more dimensions than data. For example, we're trying to predict a disease by looking at the gene expression. So the gene expression, this is just some example of a specific application that I've been talking to somebody about. So it has 600,000 these things called SNPs, which is basically what is being combined possibly as a possible contributor to a disease. The amount of data is 5,000 individuals, so it's significantly smaller than the number of SNPs. All these SNPs potentially can contribute to the disease. You don't know which ones, and you're trying to basically predict the state of a disease by looking at all these SNPs. Now, clearly, if you have only 5,000 individuals, you basically can overfit your observations and always find a linear combination of 600,000 SNPs that will give you a perfect explanation for what you've observed in 5,000 individuals, but then the next individual comes along, it's going to be basically a completely different result because a completely different combination of these SNPs possibly. So the only way you can reasonably predict some kind of behavior, good behavior here, or, systematic dependence, is assuming that only very few of those SNPs are responsible for the disease, which is a very natural assumption. The problem is that you don't know which ones. Again, it's a similar situation to these collaborative filtering, where you assume there's few factors for each movie that matter, you just don't know what they are. It's the same thing here. You assume that there's a few features that are important, you just don't know which ones. So you're trying to find a linear model, but that only uses very few of your features, basically. So it's really actually a simple model. Let's just forget the first couple of lines or whatever expressions on slide 36. Let us focus on the last expression. So what you're trying to find is a typical linear regression. So you're trying to minimize, the linear fit, AX minus B. But you're looking for a vector with the smallest number of non-zeros. So that would be picking up a few features. So your matrix A is that very kind of the matrix with a lot of columns, and you're only picking a few columns to combine to get your data vector, observation vector B. But again, this would be an NP-hard problem by itself. So instead, what you do is you relax this. The zero norm is just basically the number of non-zero. It's a notation for the number of non-zeros, but we replace it with the convex relaxation, and the convex relaxation is the sum of absolute values of x. And again, there's a fairly good mathematical explanations for that, and there's been a lot of research on that topic recently. But basically, these problems are very powerful in the sense that they do give a lot of sparse solutions, and they automatically select important features. So if you solve the problem here on slide 37, and I have two more variants of the same problem, basically, depending on what you want to solve, and they're all kind of similar to each other, but again, I'm interested in the top one, you have a basically representation of the linear regression, which will produce feature selection at the same time with producing a linear model. Okay, and again, we have a very nice sum of two functions. One is smooth, the other is not. They have a very specific structure, both of these functions, and the data is typically large dimensional. Again, this matrix A in case of the SNPs that we just described, and the expression data would be 5,000 rows and 500,000 columns. So that's a very large, completely dense matrix. Okay, and there are many cases when it's, you know, larger than that. I have one more example, but I think I will skip that example here. It basically, it's just a more complicated case of selecting a sparse covariance matrix, inverse covariance matrix. Again, it's a selecting of features, and it's based on selection of interplay of variables in a Gaussian distribution. And it's a very interesting application as well, but it leads basically to a similar kind of problem. And I'm going to skip that, so I'm going to go to now slide 42, which says solution approaches, and slide 43, which lists all the functions I've looked at basically here and just summarizes how they all have a similar structure as being a sum of two functions. Some of them are smooth, some of them are not smooth, all of them are convex, and they all fairly lie in fairly high-dimensional space that, you know, a typical Newton method kind of approaches or quasi-Newton method would not be easily implementable, at least. Okay, so now I'm very quickly going to basically describe. I have a few minutes, and they'll just basically outline the interesting algorithms that exist out there. So if we look at slide 44, we're looking at basically a sum of two functions that we're trying to optimize. And what I didn't emphasize on the previous slide, that this, each of these functions actually by itself is relatively easy in some sense. It's their combination that makes things difficult to optimize together. So what one can do is rewrite this optimization problem as the following. So we minimize the function f of x plus g of y, and we want the basically equality constraint that y has to equal to x. These two problems are equivalent, the top one and the bottom one. The bottom one is, has a constraint, but other than that, they're equivalent problem. But now we can relax this constraint via this technique called augmented Lagrangian and come up with an unconstrained problem or a sequence of unconstrained problems, rather, to solve. And now this unconstrained problem has basically two variables, x and y, and it kind of split the situation into a problem in f, in x, and a problem in y. And what we're going to do is alternatingly optimize over x and over y. And the red part here is a very simple function, actually. It's a linear function plus a very simple quadratic term, which is just, you know, has identity Hessian, so it's very simple quadratic. And then you have basically separately f and g functions. And so you can optimize over each of these functions plus the red term separately, and that becomes actually easy. And again, I'm not going to explain why that is, but you can do that, and if you do it in a certain sort of clever way, it ends up being, you know, you can view it, and I have it in slide 46, as alternatingly optimizing some kind of a linear approximations, sort of like a Taylor series expansion of f and g in alternating way. And that leads us to a lot of theoretical possibilities, which we've explored, and because of this, we've been able to prove a lot of results, not just convergence results, but convergence property, convergence rate guarantees, and many other things that are basically right now being explored in other first-order methods for these kind of problems. Now, the nice thing about these methods is that they don't require any second-order information, and the only thing you need is possibly computing the gradient, and as a matter of fact, in our case, you don't even need to compute the gradient, but you do need to be able to optimize over f and g by themselves plus these little quadratic terms, simple ones, in an efficient way. And in some cases, it's a very easy thing to do. And the examples that I gave are actually such cases. So if we go now to slide 47, I've basically summarized the issues that are being resolved, have been resolved, and we're, you know, planning to resolve in the future for this. So as I said, theoretical convergence guarantees, some of them have been provided already. but there's potential for improvement. Specifically, I did not stress it, but let me go back for a second to slide, let's say, in the very beginning, this slide 44, and I've just described the mental Lagrangian technique, but I didn't specify anything, and there are two parameters that need to be set. One is Lagrange multipliers lambdas, which are updated in a certain way in our scheme, and there's a good reason for that. And another one is this penalty parameter, mu, which has to have certain properties, but really has a fairly, wide potential of being picked to a certain way, and it's very largely responsible for the size of the steps. It's almost like a step size in any other unconstrained optimization method that we know. It can be connected with a trust region parameter in trust region methods. It can be connected with a step size parameter in line search methods. It really is responsible for how far you go. And that is a very important part of these methods, is how you select it intelligently so your step sizes are large and the method is efficient, because if you pick it too small, it is not going to be efficient. And depending on the specific setting of specific problem, the choice is easy or not so easy, and the way you can choose it intelligently may involve extra costs, such as computing extra function values and evaluating certain things along the way, which are costly because of all our high-dimensional cases. So this is where we're putting a lot of effort and work. Another thing is, as I said, in many of these cases, the function evaluations take they require evaluating every single data point, and you might have millions of those and sometimes billions. So what people often do is they ignore large parts of the data sets on certain steps of the algorithm. So they select a subset, and they say, well, the subset of the data points should tell me pretty much something about my current optimization parameters, or rather my current values of variables that I'm trying to optimize over. And I don't need to look at the entire data set. And this creates certain problems for optimization methods, and especially for picking these parameters mu. But this is a very active part of the research right now, and making it efficient for specific cases and also having theoretical guarantees is very interesting. In exact computations is part of that. Stochastic sampling of the data is another setting, which also is, if you assume your data comes from a very well-behaved, stochastic data set, then, applying stochastic sampling, subsampling of your data might reduce very substantially your work, but produce very good results. And of course, very often, all these data sets are not even fitting on one computer, so you have a distributed data set and you need to run these algorithms in parallel. And that's another thing that this algorithm would generally work well as described in high level, but making it actually efficient for every specific case and every specific application is something which requires a lot of work. And with that, I am done. Thank you.
Thank you very much. So let's see. Thank you. All right. Any questions out there from the audience?
Ignacio, I have one here. Jose Pinto from Texas.
Right.
Katya, you mentioned, take your first example, SVM, your features, they were all continuous. Mm. I'm wondering if you have a set or a subset of discrete features, how would you handle that in terms of modeling and solution?
Yeah, actually, the features are not necessarily continuous. The way they're combined, they are continuous. There's plenty of data sets, actually most of examples that I know, the features are not continuous. Like, let's say text example, right? I mean, I don't need to go back all the way there, but if we take the text categorization example, very often the feature is whether a certain word is present or not in the text, or how many times it's present in the text. So it's the only thing that is really has to be continuous is those W's, which are basically continuous weights of those features. But Other than that, the features come from all over the place. It is true that designing a good, so that's where the nonlinearity comes in. Yes, we have, let's say we have some discrete features, and then we have some continuous features, and then we have some other features. And maybe we want to weigh them all differently with different, so there comes some kind of a mapping from the original feature space into the more uniform feature space, where maybe the features would be turn into continuous scale, or, you know, somehow scale to compare with something else. It's, I'm not sure it's a science. I think it's an art, but people have been doing it very successfully for a while now, so it's definitely doable.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah, thank you. Any other question out there? Let's see. Maybe, Katya, one of the questions I have is in the support vector machine, well, some of the formulations that you indicated are non-smooth, non-differentiable. Mm-hmm. How do you tackle those problems?
Okay, so, yeah, that's a very good question. I mean, in terms of support vector machine, that's pretty much the hardest one in these, because the non-smooth term is also the one that is difficult. It's a complicated one to compute. So basically, people do apply subgradient methods, and since we're all, right now we're talking about mostly first-order methods. Well, it depends what formulation you're looking at. If you look at the formulation that I gave with constraints, you can rewrite it as a very nice convex quadratic programming problem, and that's originally, let's say 10 years ago, that's how people were solving SVMs. And then you solve it as a constraint optimization problem, and it's fine.
Right.
But it's still constraint optimization problem. Then more recently, it turned out to be, for very large cases, more efficient to treat it as a unconstrained, non-smooth problem. And there you just simply assume that you're computing subgradients. The convergence rates are slow for all these methods. However, you have to also understand that nobody really wants accurate solutions for these problems, usually, because, I mean, there are some exceptions, but usually your data is fairly inaccurate and you try to get some kind of a fairly low accuracy solutions, and for that subgradient works just fine. For the other cases, the non-smooth terms are very nice, and you can actually sort of do optimization over them in a very simple way. So there's kind of a projection you can do that that, you know, basically enables us to obtain results just as good as for smooth optimization using these non-smooth functions.
Right.
But that's because they have a very specific structure.
Okay, thank you. Yeah, come here. Yeah, there is a question here from one of the students. So,
Hello. I'm student here, and I have a question about support vector machine as well. I think in order to deal with the nonlinear case, you need to use kernel SVM. And my question is how to choose the kernel, and once you choose the kernel, how could you know that's the best you could get?
Okay, you never know that this is the best you can get. Okay, this is a subject of a lot of research, but it's not really, I wouldn't say there's a good answer yet. So, we're talking about kernel. Is basically, I didn't get to kernels here because I didn't really have the time, but it's a kind of, can be seen as the way to map something into a feature space. Of course, here we said, we would call it a quadratic kernel. It's just a kernel that maps things into quadratic functions. But more generally, there is no really good way of doing it. People typically choose a class of kernels and solve for, you know, several members of that class and then choose the best one, right? So the very standard approach in general is to, when you have some data, to hold out some of that data to be your validation set. So you actually use only part of the data for selecting the best W, so for learning, and then you check if you've done your really best by now trying to see if you can classify the remaining data that you held out in an accurate way. So this is your testing data. This is the classical setting in learning algorithm. And when you have several parameters that you have to choose to set up your optimization problem, that's what you do. So, yes, these optimization problems often have to be solved over and over again for various parameter settings. There is some work where you actually try to pick a kernel out of a set of kernels. That leads to large-scale semi-definite programming problems or second-order cone programming problems, still convex, but very large-scale. They are so far have not been so successful that they become any kind of standard. But, there's been attempt, they're successful in some cases. I think this is where kind of your combination of expert knowledge comes in. You try to pretty much figure out what kernel would work well for you. You try a few options and pick what works best.
Great, thank you. Any other question? Maybe one last quick question, Katya. In the latter part, where you talk about the alternating directions and you're doing the augmented Lagrangian decomposition, what happens if you don't include the augmented term, the quadratic term, which would be sort of like a standard Lagrangian? Because I think when you do the augmented, then of course you have the cross product term, and isn't there then also kind of a trade off, or is the performance greatly degraded if you do not include that regularization term?
So it's a good point. So basically, when you think about it, let me just go to that slide if I can. So here on slide 44, basically, if you don't include that quadratic term, it's pretty much like setting the mu very, very large, right? Because if you set mu very large, it's making the influence of this term very insignificant. And this is exactly the trade-off that we're trying to see, that if we set mu large, it allows us larger step sizes. But if you set it too large, what happens is that you do not actually, so you overstep, and what you optimize, so what you're doing is you take this function q, right, and you optimize it over x, and then you optimize it over y. And every time you optimize it, you're hoping to get an improvement in the original function, in the original objective function. So if you don't get that improvement, you basically did not, you don't guarantee convergence. I mean, let alone convergence rates. So basically, this mu parameter is essential to control how minimizing this q function relates to minimizing the true function. Because, you know, otherwise you will basically, I mean, if you don't have g, let's say, right, at all, then of course you will end up with a linear optimization problem, which will shoot off to minus infinity when you're minimizing. But because of G, you will stop somewhere, that's for sure, but because G is convex. But you still need that mu to basically keep your steps from being too large.
Right. Okay, well, I think on that tone again, thank you so much, Katya, for a very nice and very interesting and informative seminar. So we'll be in touch. And thank you again to everybody for attending this lecture. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Bye. Okay.